This is the fourth tape in a series by Dr. Robert C. Newman, professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
After having looked at liberal life in Christ and having looked at extra-biblical sources about Jesus from, say, the 450, both pagan and Jewish, we began looking last time at biblical sources about Jesus and point out, first of all, that the Pauline epistles have some very important material that one could hardly deny comes from any later than the 50s or the 60s. Then we begin to look at the Gospel of Matthew, admitting obviously that the Gospels have most of the material about Jesus, and looked a little at the authorship, date, audience, and such regarding Matthew, and in quick summary, basically pointed out that not only do all the book titles for the Gospel of Matthew all call it Matthew, but that's also the unanimous tradition of all our early sources. And one of those sources is a student of the Apostle John, and another one is a student of another student of the Apostle John. And so certainly some rather helpful things there. Regarding date, we didn't have a lot of information. There's a remark by Irenaeus to the effect that while Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel and founding the church in Rome, Matthew published his gospel. That would give us a date in probably the early 60s, maybe from 61 to 67, something like that, A.D., we will suggest, after we've looked at the date of the Gospel of Luke, that possibly Irenaeus is referring to the publication of Matthew in the Greek language rather than to its original writing in Aramaic. We'll come back and see why I think that further on down the line. We want to move now, however, to look at the Gospel of Mark, and we want to look at the same kinds of things: authorship, date, audience, characteristics, outline. What do we have about the authorship of the Gospel of Mark? Well, like the Gospel of Matthew, the text nowhere says, "I, Mark, wrote this," or something like that. We have a title, and the title occurs on all our manuscripts of Mark, says Gospel according to Mark, but we don't know for sure whether the titles go back to the very writing of the autograph or whether they were put on at a later time. We don't have much internal evidence on Mark. There are some features that we'll see seem to be illuminated by information we have from tradition about its authorship, but which you probably would never notice without that information. So we're going to just zip on over and look at the external information about authorship, and then after looking at that, I'll try to remember to sneak back and tell you what a couple of these features are in the book itself. Again, the earliest writer that tells us anything about the Gospel of Mark is this fellow Papias, a writer who had studied under the Apostle John, and who wrote one work, which we only have extracts of, quoted by a few early writers, this exposition of the oracle of the Lord. He gives us a rather extensive statement about Mark. I read it for you here. "And this the presbyter used to say. Mark, indeed, since he was the interpreter of Peter, wrote accurately, but not in order, the things either said or done by the Lord, as much as he remembered. For he neither heard the Lord nor followed him, but afterwards, as I've said, heard and followed Peter, who fitted his discourses to the needs of his hearers, but not as if making a narrative of the Lord's saying. Consequently, Mark, writing some things just as he remembered, erred nothing, for he was careful of one thing, not to omit any of the things he had heard, or to falsify anything in them." Several interesting things about this statement. One of them is that Papias is telling us this is not something that he thought up. This is something he heard from somebody earlier than his time. And he uses this word presbyter, which has kind of a Presbyterian ring to it. Probably the word should here be translated elder, though we could quibble about that, I suppose. And the best guess is that he's referring to the author of 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, who calls himself in 2nd, 3rd John, the presbyter, the elder. And that person, we understand from very early information, is John himself. So apparently Papias is telling us some information that the Apostle John passed on to him. Now, the trick is to figure out where the Apostle John starts and where he stops and where Papias starts and stops. But my guess is that the Apostle John starts with Mark indeed and ends with remembered right there after the parenthesis that has Peter, question mark, Mark, question mark. That is, Mark indeed, since he was the interpreter of Peter, wrote accurately but not in order the things either said or done by the Lord, as much as he remembered. Then it looks like Papias is now explaining a statement, perhaps a statement he memorized. We know that at Papias' time, the students of a rabbi would memorize their teaching word for word. And then they would explain what the teaching meant. In other words, they not only had heard the guy state the particular things, but they knew what he meant by them because they had asked him questions about it and such. But their method of learning was to memorize brief presentations, but lots of them, and then to explain what was meant. This, in fact, is the way the oral tradition of the rabbis from ancient times is written up from, say, 500 A.D. We have a rather small work called the Mishnah, very compressed sayings of the early rabbis, written about 200. And then, since the average person reading that can't figure out what's going on, an elaborate explanation of it, written up between 200 and 550, that explains the material. My suggestion is we've got something of that sort going on right here. So we have this slightly enigmatic statement, which, however, still says this. Mark wrote something. He wrote it as the interpreter of Peter. Then you've got this not-in-order remark. That's rather strange. Most persons today who are studying gospel areas are inclined to think that if any gospel is in chronological order, it's Mark. There are places where Matthew diverges from Mark, and it's thought to be because Matthew has taken certain things and put them in the topical order. And once in a while, Luke goes off in another direction from the order followed by Mark. But in general, the feeling is that Mark is in order. My suggestion here is he's probably talking here not about Mark writing down the gospel at this point, but Mark writing down incidents as Peter used them in preaching, recalling things that had happened in Jesus' ministry. So he wrote them down when he heard them, not then in order, and then he later compiles it. And the things he wrote down were the things either done or said by the Lord, so two topics of types of material, sayings of Jesus and actions of Jesus. That, of course, fits all the Gospels really well. And he wrote down as much as he remembered. And you could argue about who that he remembered is, but we're right that the not in order has to do with Mark writing down things as Peter narrates them as illustrations in his teaching, then it's as much as Peter remembered what's going on here. Well, then you go on and get this further explanation by Papias explaining what's going on here. This is rather important when we realize it's written down about 130. So it was written down while Papias was still in the prime of his life, and he had himself studied under the Apostle John, who presumably knew these kinds of things. Notice also a rather strong statement about accuracy of the material, which, of course, does not go over well with liberals, who, if the gospel is accurate, then their religion is wrong. And that, I think, is a serious problem. Okay, we move on then to Justin Martyr. We've not run into him yet in any of these citations of tradition on the authorship and date of the various Gospels. Martyr is not his last name, it's a title. His name was Justin, and he didn't get the title until he died a martyr's death. So, not the name he used. He died about 165 A.D. That's what the symbol there for is in the handout. I don't have a quotation here exactly. Well, I do down the middle of it have a quotation here. Again and again, Justin, in either of two works he wrote, an apology, which is written to the Roman emperor trying to defend Christianity against those charges made, and then a sort of a debate which he had with a Jewish fellow named Trypho. He again and again uses the term Memoirs of the Apostles, and once or twice says the Memoirs of the Apostles called Gospels. So apparently his way of explaining to a non-Christian audience what the Gospels are is to call them Memoirs of the Apostles. That is, a writing that recalls things that the apostles had experienced. Having referred several times to these memoirs, in this dialogue with Trypho, chapter 106, he's just mentioned the Apostle Peter, and then Justin says it is written in his memoirs that he changed Peter's name, as well as the sons of Zebedee, Boanerges. And we, of course, know that Jesus did change Peter's name. Peter's name was actually Simon, rather standard sort of Jewish name, and he gave him kind of a nickname, which was not a normal name at all. Peter, it's quite a normal name now, but it wasn't back then. Neither was Cephas, which is the Aramaic of it. Both of them have become normal names because of the importance of Peter in early church history, and because there have been lots of Christians, parents wanting to name their kids good names and that sort of thing. The name actually means rock, and is not quite like our nickname Rocky or something like that. But in any case, it wasn't the kind of name the parents named Peter. So the point we want to make here is apparently, Justin says, it is written in Peter's memoirs that Christ changed Peter's name as well as the sons of Zebedee, Boanerges. Now, the remark about giving Peter a nickname occurs in, I think, three of the Gospels. But the remark about him giving a nickname to James and John, Boanerges, that occurs only in Mark. And so apparently, Justin is telling us that the Gospel of Mark can be called Peter's memoirs. He never named the Gospels, by the way. He just called them memoirs of the apostles. That, again, fits in very nicely with Papias. As far as we know, Justin had no contact with Papias or with Polycarp, the fellow who was the teacher of Irenaeus down here that we're going to look at next. Justin Martyr was a pagan, born in Samaria, Gentile, born in Samaria, city of Samaria, and got saved after he was an adult and after he'd already studied a number of the Greek philosophers. And then he began himself to be a Christian philosopher, going around from town to town teaching Christianity, but continuing to dress like a philosopher. He had some kind of distinctive dress, I'm not sure I could describe it, and such, until he was martyred about 165 AD. The city of Samaria, which had been refounded by Herod the Great, and really was pretty much a pagan city through the New Testament period. Third fellow we've got listed here is Irenaeus. We've mentioned him already. Born in Asia Minor, studied under the fellow Polycarp, who was one of John's students, went out from Asia Minor over to France to help with the Christian missionary work there, and eventually became the head, the bishop of the church at Lyon, a city that still exists in southern France. And he's giving us a sort of summary of the authorship and date of the gospel in a little paragraph here, and I'm quoting pieces of it as we come by. So the front part of it, Matthew published, etc., while Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome and founding the church. After their exodus, is actually the word used there, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter, also handed down to us in writing the things preached by Peter. The word exodus here is tricky. It can have two rather different meanings. One of them would be their exodus from the city, just been referring to Rome, and the other would be their exodus from his life, death. You can find the word used both ways. And so the question is Irenaeus telling us that Mark was written after the death of Peter and Paul, or only after Peter and Paul left the city of Rome for some reason or other? Well, we don't know for sure from that statement. However, Clement of Alexandria rather explicitly represents Peter as still being alive when Mark was written. I think we said a word or two about Clement last time again. He is one of the four teachers we know by name. I guess there's some more, but the four earliest teachers of the catechetical school in Alexandria, kind of a combination of catechetical school, Sunday school, college, seminary, etc., for the Christian church in Alexandria. He's writing about 200, as it's here. The gospel according to Mark at this occasion, he just said in the previous part of the sentence, the gospels with the genealogies were written first, but the gospel according to Mark at this occasion. When Peter had preached the word publicly in Rome and had declared the gospel by the Spirit, those who were present, there were many, besought Mark, since he had followed him for a long time and remembered the things that had been spoken, to write out the things that had been said. And when he had done this, he gave the gospel to those who had asked him. When Peter learned of it later, he neither obstructed it nor commended it. Rather, puzzling statement. Notice some things about it. Again, it's got Mark writing down Peter's preaching, Peter's memories of what was going on. So we get that really in all three of these, all four of these so far. Here, you seem to get a picture that Peter's not around when he does it, which would fit the idea that the exodus mentioned in Irenaeus is a departure from the city of Rome. You certainly don't get the idea that the exodus is the death of Peter, since Peter learns about it later and he doesn't know how to respond to it. He hasn't been given any special message that God wanted him to have some such thing written, but he hasn't had anything against it, so he doesn't know how to respond. He doesn't either obstruct or commend it. So that rather interesting statement. We're getting somewhat further away from the event here now. We have one other writer, though, from around 200, and that's this fellow Tertullian. Tertullian is from North Africa, over an area called Carthage, where the area that Augustine is from later in church history. He just has this very brief remark. So then of apostles, John and Matthew instill us with faith of apostolic men, Luke and Mark renew it. we see this four gospel type approach. We can't tell for sure whether he's talking about some chronological order or not. It looks like he does the apostles and the apostolic men, rather than telling us who wrote first, second, third, and fourth. Origen is writing perhaps around 230 or a little later, so a little generation later than these, as in Clement and Tertullian. And he's giving us a list like Irenaeus does. He says something about, according to the canonical order, first Matthew, and then this, and secondly, there was written the gospel according to Mark, who made it as Peter instructed him, whom also he acknowledges as his son in the Catholic epistle, in these words, the church in Babylon went together with you, and Mark, my son, salutes you. What's difficult to tell is whether Origen intends by secondly that Mark was written second, or whether he intends by secondly the second in the order in which they occur in the canon, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. It looks like, at least as far as I can tell, that some of the early writers think that that is the chronological order in which the books were written. Matthew first, Mark second, Luke third, John fourth. But we know that at least one author contradicts that. That Clement, as we saw in our last discussion, Clement of Alexandria says the Gospels with the genealogies were written first. So that would be either Matthew, Luke, or Luke, Matthew. And then he puts gives Mark after that, and he gives John after that. So there's some question there on exactly what order we've got. If we try and put all this together and summarize the whole situation of authorship, which I do on page 103 for those of you who've got syllabi, we can say that Mark wrote the gospel ascribed to him as unanimous opinion of tradition, as is the belief that he gives Peter's teaching. So the gospel of Mark rather clearly associated with Peter. It's not just something that Mark did. It is Peter's teaching that's going on here. It's interesting that these traditions are consistent with the nature of the gospel itself in a stronger and more obvious way than was the case with Matthew. We have a very strong tradition that Matthew wrote the gospel, but very little in the gospel that would tell you one way or another who it might have been. It's Jewish, but all the apostles were Jewish. That doesn't tell you much. Perhaps the only clue for the gospel of Matthew, having once seen that that's who it's by, is that when you get to list the apostles in each of the gospels, the only one that says the tax collector after Matthew is Matthew's gospel. All the others, that was really not a high-class occupation in antiquity. It all paid pretty well, but was not a looked-up-to occupation in antiquity. He's the only one that says it. We do get a little bit more hint, perhaps, in the Gospel of Mark of who might be the author, given that we already then have some information as to who it is. We can see these things. One of them, I think, is a very strange incident that occurs in Mark 14, verses 51 and 52. Some fellow whom we've heard nothing else about anywhere in the gospel, who is not named, is out in the Garden of Gethsemane at the arrest of Jesus, wearing a sheep, a somewhat unusual dress. And when the crowd grabs for the disciples, the only one that gets grabbed is the sheep. And the fellow makes it home without the sheep. My suggestion is that that is probably Mark's only direct contact, if you like, with the more exciting events of the gospel. My construction here, and I did not invent the idea, though it's certainly speculative, is that since we know that Mark's family had a room in which Christians met early in church history, maybe that's the place where the upper room of the Last Supper was held. Imagine Mark going to bed, etc. Somebody's got one of their rooms rented out or whatever for the Last Supper. And then suddenly, after he's been asleep for an hour or two, there's banging on the door and torches and everybody standing out in the street, where is he, where is he, where is he, etc. And then the crowd moves off, and Mark realizes they're after Jesus. He grabs his sheep and sneaks out the door and goes to follow them, and almost gets himself caught when he gets out there. That's speculative, but it's quite an interesting suggestion, and really don't know what to say. A couple of writers have suggested it's rather like the author of a painting putting his signature down in the corner somewhere. The obscure sort of location. The other feature of the Gospel of Mark, which we'll come back to in a bit, which perhaps is supports the tradition we've seen, is that there are a number of features about the Gospel that remind us of Peter's personality. Peter, the one who jumps from one thing to another very quickly, so does the Gospel of Mark. Peter seems to have one of those imaginative temperaments, and you can see some very imaginative things in how vividly things are portrayed in the Gospel of Mark. I'll wait and come back to that. I don't think you'd ever guess who was the author of it without the traditional information, But I think seeing the traditional information, you can see some ways in which that's understandable. The third thing we want to say here regarding the conclusions on authorship is that some see a contradiction in the tradition regarding date. Irenaeus is often interpreted as saying that Mark wrote after Peter's death, whereas Clement is understood, or is quite clearly says, that Peter, Mark wrote at such a time that Peter learned about it afterwards. And it's pretty clear he's still alive. But my suggestion is that's not a necessary interpretation, and it's not unreasonable to suggest. Peter and Paul were founding the church in Rome, but then left Rome for one reason or another. We have some hints on why Paul might have done that, but went further to Spain. Just why Peter might have left, no idea, except that he seems to have moved around. We find him in Jerusalem at one point, we find him up in Samaria at one point, we find him in Antioch at one point, and according to tradition, he was in Rome. The people in Corinth know about him. I don't know whether he ever visited there or not. There's this Peter party along with the Apollo's party and the Paul party and the Christ party, etc. So impression you get is that he did move around a good deal. He was itinerant, as Paul was, and so that he left Rome somewhere with not being reasonable. Well, let's move on then to deal with this related question of date. And that's on page 106 of the syllabus, for those of you who've got it. Again, there's very little internal evidence that would give you a date. Liberals, again, because they don't believe in prophecy, and yet because of some rather striking things about the fall of Jerusalem and such predicted in Mark 13, say, well, Mark must have been written around or shortly after the fall of Jerusalem. For those who believe, as the Bible teaches, that God can predict the future, and Christ can predict the future, and that God's prophets can predict the future, that obviously gives no dating information in the question. There is some external information. Irenaeus here says Matthew published his gospel while Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome, founding the church. After their departure, Mark did thus and so. Clement of Alexandria, when Peter had preached the word publicly in Rome and declared the gospel by the Spirit, those who were present besought Mark to write out the things that had been said. Both of those sound like they are written somewhere around the time Peter has already proclaimed the gospel in Rome. When was that? Well, the Roman Catholic Church tells us that Peter was Pope, Bishop of Rome, for 25 years before his death. And calculate that back to get back in the 40s somewhere. And what they say is that when Peter was released from prison by the angel and he went off to another place, as the book of Acts says, the other place was Rome. Some very serious problems with that, however. The biggest one is this. Paul arrives in Rome about 61 A.D., let's say. That's good to a year or so. After a shipwreck on Malta, etc. He arrives, he calls the Jewish community leaders together and they come to visit him in his house. And he begins to explain the gospel to them. And they say, we don't know anything about this gospel except that it's spoken against everywhere. Why don't you tell us what it's all about? Now, that sounds like a pretty bad situation if Peter has been preaching the gospel for 20 years in Rome at that point. But if Peter's never been in Rome, and the few Christians that are in Rome have gotten there by immigration from other locations, we might very well expect some such situation to be the case. My suggestion is Peter had not gotten to Rome by the time Paul arrived in 61, and yet the tradition is very strong that Peter was put to death in Rome at the end of Nero's reign, maybe around 67. So somewhere between 61 and 67, Peter and Paul are in Rome, helping get the church organized and running well, and those obviously were Christians at the time. And that's the time then that Matthew publishes his gospel, and that's the time shortly right after that is the time that Mark does this. But apparently right away, Peter has just preached the gospel publicly in Rome, and the people who are there ask Mark if he won't put together the material that Peter remembers that he's taken down at this time. That would suggest mid-60s somewhere for the date of Mark. That's the direction I would suggest we go on that. Let's move over then to consider the question of the audience of Mark. Who is Mark writing for? Well, last time when we were discussing Matthew, we pointed out that it looks like Matthew is writing for Jews because he has all these Jewish customs in there that he doesn't explain, and that even modern translators often find it necessary to add a few words to Matthew's account so that the reader today can understand what's going on about the fringes being long and the phylacteries broad and those sorts of things. Mark has much of the same material that Matthew does, but he nearly always explains complicated things. When there's something about cleansing for the Jews, Matthew mentions it, says nothing else. Mark takes about three verses to explain the kind of things they cleanse. Mark, we'll find, uses several foreign words in his account. Of course, they're all foreign words to us. They're all Greek. But he uses in the Greek several words which are Aramaic words. And almost every time he stops and translates them. We'll look at those in just a minute under some of the particular characteristics of Mark as well. These two things, the translation of Aramaic phrases and the explanation of Jewish customs, sound like he's not writing for Jews. Well, when you use the designation Jew-Gentile to divide up everybody, then that means he's writing for Gentiles. Well, that's easy enough. Some persons have wanted to narrow it further to say he's writing for Romans, and that certainly is agreeable to what Clement had to say about when Peter had preached the gospel in Rome, the people who heard him, who many besought him to write down these, besought Mark to write down these things. There are a few Latin words in Mark as well, and some have taken that as evidence that he's writing for Romans who naturally would know Latin words. Of course, some of the Roman slaves might only know Greek, but everybody else in Rome presumably would know Latin, at least everybody native to Rome would presumably know Latin. However, when you actually look at the words that he uses for Latin words, they're the kind of Latin words you suspect everybody would know, given that the Roman Empire has been in power for nearly 100 years by this time. He uses the Latin word for the flagella, the Roman whip, which was kind of a wooden-handled job with leather thongs on the end, and then out on the end of that pieces of bone or iron, a nasty device, but something which probably everybody in the empire had seen or heard at one time due to the Roman method of administration. He also uses the word centurion several times. What does not show up in your English Bibles is that he uses the Latin word centurion converted into Greek letters, whereas Matthew and Luke use the Greek word for centurion, a ruler of 100 people, what both of them mean. But I'm not sure how much you can make of that. That must have been a familiar term, again, to people throughout the empire, given the length of time the Romans had been in control. So I think we don't have enough information in the book itself to say that he's writing particularly for Romans as opposed to somebody else, but we do have enough information to say he's writing for Gentiles as opposed to Jews. I think there's little question about that. Given the tradition that he's writing to Romans, there's some other features that may suggest why the Romans were particularly excited to hear Peter's preaching, and why they wanted Mark to write up a gospel, and that may have to do with the Roman temperament, very practical, not very theoretically oriented, very action-oriented, etc., and that seems to be the way Peter was. Peter was very action-oriented, Peter was very practical, etc., and it may then be that his presentation of the gospel struck it off very particularly with the Roman temperament. But I wouldn't want to be too dogmatic in many areas. Let's say a few words about some characteristics of the Gospel of Mark. Again, these are sketched for you on page 108, 109 of the syllabus. We have, I've got it in two categories here, I'm not sure it belongs in two categories, a certain vividness in Mark that you don't see so much in the other Gospels. That is, certain types of picturesque details or graphic details that really aren't needed to advance the story, but they help you picture the situation. there's a remark at the feeding of the 5,000 that they reclined on the green grass. And the other Gospels don't mention that. There are several remarks about Jesus looking around, or looking around with anger, or looking with compassion or something. There's more about Jesus' emotions in the Gospel of Mark than in any of the other Gospels, and suggests that someone who was present, that is at the source of the Gospel of Mark, was someone who was struck by those things. Some people are struck by certain kinds of details, other people are struck by other kinds of details, and some of us are hardly struck by any kind of details. But I'm not a particularly observant type, I'm afraid, so I usually can't tell what color something was unless it was unusual and I happen to notice it. Whereas my brother, who's an artist, and usually knows that notices the color of anything he sees. So I think we see that. We also see something which doesn't come through in English very well either, that Mark very frequently uses the present tense for his verbs, which gives kind of a vividness to the narrative, as though it's going on, as though you are there, if you like, kind of English expression for trying to get you to imagine the action going on right at the moment. It's not quite like the English. In English, sometimes in graphic descriptions, a person will use the present tense, but that in general is a very colloquial thing in English, where it's a little more refined in Greek language. So a little bit there. Related to this vividness, but not always involving just the vividness, we find something rather striking about the Gospel of Mark. Gospel of Mark is the shortest of the four Gospels. And yet, if you actually pull out the incidents it narrates and sit the incident next to the parallel incidents in Luke and Matthew and once in a while in John, it's nearly always the case, or at least mostly the case, that Mark's description is longer. Even though it's a shorter Gospel, the description of the events he narrates are frequently longer than they are in the other Gospels. More detail. He gives more detail of what he does give. He does not give nearly as many incidents as either Matthew or Luke do. There's also kind of a breathless activity to the Gospel of Mark. Again and again, a new narrative starts with the word immediately, right away, etc. Not sure exactly how to translate the word, actually, but it has something to do with just then, next, right away, something of that sort, and kind of gives you the idea of Mark is action-oriented. This happens, then this happens right after, this happens right after. That is a rather striking thing as well. I mentioned that Mark is packed with miracles. Though a short gospel, it's really got nearly as many miracles narrated as the other gospels do. It stresses Jesus' actions much more than his words. There's really only a couple passages where Jesus' words are given in a very long discourse. I think there's one of them a chapter long, Mark 13, and all of the other ones are substantially shorter than that. Generally, it's a few brief sentences, and then this action and that action, etc. Much more oriented that way. Some people have tried to characterize each of the different Gospels in terms of how they picture Christ. And we can see very easily from Matthew that Matthew pictures Christ as king. Gives him a genealogy, and it's a royal genealogy, and it emphasizes the fulfillment of messianic prophecy in him and such, though of course that shows up in all the Gospels, emphasizes the kingdom of heaven, such. If we were to try to use something like that from Mark, I think probably the best suggestion would be Mark represents Jesus as a servant. I don't think there's any explicit statement in Mark that would suggest that he's telling you that's what he's doing. But we do see that he doesn't have a genealogy. And one thing servants didn't need was a genealogy. Okay? They're slaves, okay? What are you interested in a slave? What they do. And that obviously is what the Gospel of Mark is interested in. What did Jesus do? Obviously it deals with what he said as well, because he's God's slave. He's God's suffering servant. And as God's servant, he has God's message. So that's part of what he does. But there's still much, much more emphasis on his action. Also, as you're aware, the Gospel of Mark doesn't have anything about Jesus' birth or early life. It starts out immediately with his appearance before John the Baptist, has a sentence or two to describe John the Baptist, and then Jesus immediately shows up on scene. And so I think it's not unfair to characterize Mark as picturing Jesus as the servant, as Matthew pictures him as the king. Well, so we've got this vividness, this detail. We've got this activity. We've got Jesus pictured as a servant. And we have, as I mentioned before, many Aramaic words that have been recorded in Mark. I think that's probably part of the vividness, that Peter remembers the very words that were said. And he says them. But, of course, for Mark to repeat them is not too illuminating for the Romans. They don't know Aramaic. So he translates each one of them. He gives the word and then translates it. So you have this word Boanerges, the name that he gave, the nickname that he gave to James and John. But none of us would know what that means unless we had the translation in front of us some hundred. And then when he raises this little girl, Jairus' daughter, he says, Talitha kumi, little girl, rise up. And when he heals the deaf mute, he says, Ephatha, be open. And even when he heals this fellow Bartimaeus, Mark goes out of his way to explain Bartimaeus means son of Timaeus, which is something we probably would know. We probably heard Bar something enough by now, having read the Bible. But remember, his readers may not have read the Bible before, particularly if they're Romans, Gentiles. He does explain that. He explains the term Abba, Father. He's not the only one to do that, but the only gospel to even use the term. And of course, he shares some Aramaic words with the other gospels, Korban, Golgotha, Eloi, Eloi, Lama Sabachthani, and such. But there are more of them in Mark, and they're generally explained in Mark, whereas they're not in the others. There are some words like rabbi and such that are not explained in Mark, nor in Matthew, nor in John, where they occur as well. But that's probably because there were enough Jews around that most Gentiles knew that rabbi was some kind of a teacher term in Judaism, just as we do today. You ask the average person on the street what a rabbi is, and they'll tell you, well, it's a Jewish preacher or a Jewish pastor or something like that. Well, that term might not be quite right. It's certainly in the ballpark. So we're looking at a word there that was already common knowledge in Jewish circles. Well, to wind up our discussion tonight, let's take a quick look at a sketch outline of Mark, and you'll see this on page 110 of your syllabus. If you're to compare this with the sketch outline of Matthew, which is back on page 99, you'll see they got all the same items in them pretty well. That's because I named all the items the same, okay? But the material's really there. The biggest difference is there's no birth narrative and there's no genealogy in Mark, whereas there is in Matthew. Otherwise, preparation for ministry, Galilean ministry, journey to Jerusalem last week, betrayal, trial, crucifixion, resurrection, they're all in Mark, just like they're in Matthew. The big difference, I think, would be that Mark spends about as much space on the journey to Jerusalem the last week, betrayal, trial, crucifixion, and resurrection, as Matthew does, but he's got a lot shorter gospel. And so there's not as much space left for anything else. The Galilean ministry takes up about half the gospel, but it does the same in Matthew. To a substantial extent, the gospel of Matthew is sort of a biographical preparation for the last week of Jesus' ministry, which occupies about a third of the gospel. One scholar has said the Gospel of Mark is a passion narrative with a long prologue. Well, that's true. Well, it's got long, a long prologue. So half the gospel, okay, is a prologue. So that's a little overdone. But certainly a big emphasis on Jesus' death and resurrection. And then about an equal emphasis on the whole rest of his ministry. That's probably a fair way to represent it. Okay, we got to quit there for the session. Next time we'll come back and do the same sorts of things with the Gospel of Luke. We will spend a little time here on the aim and method of the Gospel of Luke because he tells us something about it. Didn't spend any time on Matthew or Mark because they don't explicitly tell us what their aim or method is. There is some internal evidence in the Gospel of Luke that's rather helpful. Again, as with Matthew and Mark, there's no statement, I, Luke, wrote this or anything like that. There's the title, and that occurs in all the manuscripts we've got, and it's always according to Luke. It's not according to anybody else. But we do have some other information. We have, for instance, a definite linkage between the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts. If you look, each has got a prologue, and the prologue of Acts starts out, the former treatise, O Theophilus, I wrote of all that Jesus began to do and to teach until the day he was taken up, etc. It goes on. And the first one starts out with some remarks to Theophilus. But quite clearly, there's a linkage between those two. And the book of Acts contains a number of interesting sections where the author begins to say, we did this and that, instead of just they did this and that, apparently hinting that he was present with Paul and Silas at several places in their ministry. We won't go into any long discussion of that right here. But that obviously is of some interest. Apparently the author of the Gospel of Luke was a traveling companion with the Apostle Paul on his second and third missionary journeys and on his voyage to Rome under guard. Another rather striking feature about the Gospel of Luke, which it shares with the book of Acts, is it's got a very substantial medical vocabulary. Not so noticeable in English, because English translators translate into English you understand, and sometimes they don't use technical medical terms. But we've got technical medical vocabulary in several of the ancient Greek writers, particularly Hippocrates and Galen, and in them we find a number of specialized terms that show up in the Gospel of Luke that do not show up in parallel passages of Mark and Matthew and such. And this fellow William Hobart, whom I mentioned on page 111, has demonstrated that in a not particularly exciting book as reading, because it's just a list of vocabulary words and where they occur, but a rather exciting book in that it shows some internal evidence that is rather suggestive for the authorship of this particular gospel. Well, we want to just mention those and then move on to look at the whole question of external evidence regarding the authorship and date of Luke. We don't know whether Papias said anything about the authorship of the Gospel of Luke in his exposition of the oracle of the Lord, because no one has seen fit to preserve us a complete copy of it. And if he did, none of the early writers of whom we have copies happened to quote it. So we really don't know whether Papias said anything about the authorship of Luke and John or not. He does say something about Matthew and Mark, as we cited in our earlier material. The earliest material we've got comes from about the time of Irenaeus, and we have two sources from that time, Irenaeus himself, whom we'll look at in a moment, and another work, which we call the Muratorian Canon. That name is not super helpful. Perhaps you're aware that canon is a term used for a list of books in Scripture, and that's how it's being used in this thing. This is a fragment of a manuscript copied in the 8th century in very poor Latin, and it was discovered in the Renaissance period by a fellow named Muratori. That's called the Muratorian Canon. We don't know who wrote it, but there's reason to believe from a couple of remarks in it that he was a church official of some sort in Italy, perhaps in Rome. And we can guess approximately when he wrote it by the remark that he mentions a work called The Shepherd of Hermas, the early 2nd century work, and says it was written by Hermas, the brother of the Bishop Clement, almost in their own time. So he apparently is not far away from that. This sort of date we've got here, late 2nd century, is what we think it to be. The work is fragmental, not only apparently in its Latin form that we've got, but probably the form which the guy had when he translated into Latin was fragmented as well. It starts out in the middle of a sentence, and it ends up broken at the other end, and some people think it was also broken in the middle somewhere, though it's not broken in Latin at that point. The writer apparently did not know either Latin or Greek too well. One would guess that part of the problem is you're in a period when education has fallen on very hard times in Italy, in the Dark Ages part of the medieval period. The original writer himself, however, is back in the 2nd century. And it starts out in the middle of this sentence, but he was present among them, and so he put, plunk. And the parenthesis there, the facts down in his gospel, are probably what the writer means, since the next sentence starts out, the third book of the gospel is that according to Luke. Luke, the physician, after the ascension of Christ, when Paul had taken him with him as a companion in his traveling, and after he made an investigation, wrote in his own name. But neither did he see the Lord in the flesh, and thus, as he was able to investigate, he also begins to tell the story, starting with the nativity of John. Well, that information tells us that we're definitely looking at the Gospel of Luke. That's the only gospel that starts out with the birth of John and narrates anything about that. And it fits in with everything else we know about Luke, and he puts it the third book of the gospel. It's a good bet that he was talking about Matthew and Mark as the first and second books of the gospel, though in fact the manuscript is broken there. He does go on to talk about John, as we'll see in our discussion of that next week. So apparently, church official from Italy, possibly Rome. He talks about the city on a couple of cases where he obviously means Rome. We talk about the city around here, we probably mean Wilmington, I would guess. We talk about the city up in our area, we do not mean Hatfield, we mean Philadelphia. So usually it's the big city that's near you, and in his context it's quite clearly talking about Rome. So that's what we know about that work. Irenaeus we know more about. I've already told you about him several times. A student of Polycarp, who was a student of John. And we're in the middle of his same little paragraph here. I'm trying to show you how it all fits together. Now, Matthew published the gospel, etc., while Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome and founding the church. After their departure, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter, etc., handed down to us, writing the things preached by Peter. Luke also, the follower of Paul, put down in a book the gospel preached by that one. Afterward, John, and he goes on. So he gives you the canonical order. Notice some of it is chronological. Matthew published while Peter and Paul were doing this, after their departure, Mark, afterwards John. The one strange thing about it is that there's nothing explicitly chronological about where he puts Luke. I think if we're reading this naturally, we'd say, well, obviously he means Luke is third. And that would be the natural way to understand it. But he doesn't say afterwards Luke or something like that. It doesn't really quite give the order there. I read you again what Clement says, which I also gave you for Matthew. Origen is, excuse me, Eusebius is describing what Clement says in a book that we don't have. Again, in the same books, Clement gives a tradition of the early presbyters, that is, earlier than his own time, concerning the order of the Gospels in the following manner. He said that those Gospels which contained the genealogies were written first, but the Gospel according to Mark had this occasion, goes on with a little that we've got on the other sheet, last of all, John, and we'll see what he has to say about that. So he has Matthew and Luke first, though he doesn't tell you what their order is, then he has Mark and then John. Tertullian has the same remark we read last time. So then of apostles, John and Matthew instill us with faith, of apostolic men, Luke and Mark renew it. For Luke's gospel, similarly, men are used to ascribe to Paul. Origen, going through his list, which he says is canonical order, first Matthew, second Mark, and thirdly, that according to Luke, the gospel praised by Paul, who made it for those from the Gentiles who believed. And finally, Eusebius in his church history. We're now getting pretty far away from the events, but Eusebius did have access to material we don't. Luke, in regard to race, being of those of Antioch, that's the tradition antiquity, he was from Antioch, where Paul's first worked with a Gentile church, but by profession of position, since he had been very much with Paul and had no mean association with the rest of the apostles, left us examples of the therapy of souls, which he acquired from them in two inspired books. The Gospel, which he testifies that he also wrote according to what those handed down to him, who were eyewitnesses from the beginning and ministers of the word, all of whom he also says he had followed even from the beginning, and the Acts of the Apostles, which he composed from what he had learned, not by hearing, but with his eyes. But men say that Paul was accustomed to refer to his gospel whenever writing as if it were about some gospel of his own, he said, according to my gospel. I am skeptical of that remark about Eusebius, since you find it's in Romans 2:16 and Romans 6:25, and they're written around 56-57 A.D., and I think we can show fairly likely that Luke probably wasn't written that early. So I think according to my gospel, Paul means according to the gospel message I'm preaching, not according to the gospel of St. Luke, which I am using in my ministry. So I think we'll have to take that one as a bad guess by Eusebius. That, of course, is one reason why many people are suspicious of tradition. You can't always tell whether the guy is guessing or whether he knows. And so you're on safer ground with the earlier writers, and you're on safer ground with the writers that you know have some connections with what they're talking about, which is why Papias and Irenaeus are naturally to be preferred in those directions. Yes, sir? So far, we've not gotten an explicit statement in that. Clement says Matthew and Luke were written first. The Gospels of genealogy were written first, and he doesn't date Mark. Irenaeus has this Matthew while Peter and Paul were in Rome, early 60s, after the departure of Mark. But then when he lists Luke, he doesn't say whether Luke is after Mark. He just says Luke also. What we're going to have to do is work a little argument to suggest the date of Luke, which we'll get down to here in just a minute. Let me try and summarize the authorship situation. That Luke, a follower of Paul, a physician, wrote the gospel, ascribed to him as the unanimous opinion of tradition, although we have no remarks quite so early as those of Papias on Matthew and Mark. However, by about 200 AD, when we've got Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, Irenaeus, Muratorian Canon, Origen, etc., we've got a writer from Italy, Muratorian Canon, South France, but grew up in Asia Minor, Irenaeus, Clement and Origen, Alexandria, and Tertullian over here in Carthage. You've got pretty well a coverage of the whole Roman Empire. So by about 200, all over the Roman Empire, there's a knowledge of Luke as the author of the third gospel. That the author was a physician who traveled with Paul is consistent with the internal evidence of the gospel, the vocabulary of a very medical sort, which requires at least a person familiar with technical medical vocabulary. There are other people in our society, even physicians, who are familiar with that, but there probably wouldn't be many of them in antiquity, because most of those people are insurance examiners and other sorts of people that there weren't many of in ancient times. And so I think we really do have strong evidence in the direction there concerning the authorship. I'll say one thing about Luke the physician. We've got a section here in the notes, but not time to discuss it. We have excellent evidence that Luke is a Gentile. You occasionally hear writers say all the writers in the New Testament were Jews. That cannot be true. There's a remark in the end of Colossians where Paul's sending greetings from the people where he is and sending them to the people he's writing to. And he lists two fellows and he says, these are all those of the circumcision who are with me. Forgot who he lists. You'll have to look up in Colossians 4 and see what it is. Then he lists Luke and Demas and say they send their greetings. So the two previous ones are all the Jews that are with him, and these two aren't. And so it's pretty clear then that Luke is a Gentile. And the suggestion in Eusebius, and I think also in Jerome, that he's from Antioch, is a reasonable suggestion, though we really do not know whether that's so. They're not real early persons. But doubtless, if Luke was from Antioch, the people in the church would remember that once his gospel began to circulate. So it's something that probably was known at Eusebius' time. It's something he could have just found out by talking to people in the church there. Let's move on then to try and discuss this question of the date. I've divided up our discussion of date, which starts on page 117 for those with syllabi, into internal evidence and external evidence. Internal evidence, got this. The Gospel of Luke was pretty clearly written before the book of Acts. Acts says, a former treatise, O Theophilus, I wrote of all that Jesus began to do and to teach until the day was taken up, etc. Which referring back to the Gospel of Luke. That would suggest then that if we can date the book of Acts, the Gospel of Luke comes from before then. Liberals, again, go with this sort of idea. Well, look at this stuff in Luke 21 about the fall of Jerusalem. If this is what happens, and we know prophecy doesn't occur, therefore it's written after 70. So your liberals almost invariably write, put down Luke as written after 70 AD. But again, as I say, we believe that God is able to tell the future because he controls it, and that Christ himself is God. And even if he weren't, he's still a prophet. And even the prophets, because of God's information, can tell the future. So we can't use a person when they're telling us, they're predicting, to late date something after the fulfillment of the prediction. So that's really the internal evidence. Connection with Luke, connection with Acts, and the question of the predictions. external evidence, we have some rather definite things we can say about the authorship of the book of Acts. We've seen, first of all, the book of Acts appears to be written after Luke because it refers to Luke rather than the other way around. The second thing we can say is there are two things missing from the book of Acts that ought to be there if the book of Acts were written much later than about 63 or 64 AD. One of these is there's no hint in the book of Acts that the Roman government is hostile to Christianity. And yet from the Roman fire in the summer 64 AD, off until actually till 300 or so, Christianity is considered to be a subversive activity because they were connected with the fire of Rome. So no hint of that in the book of Acts. Liberals have tried to claim that the book of Acts is attempting to show that Christians got along all right with Rome at an earlier period, which certainly they did. But there's just no breath of the sort of thing that you ought to have there is, well, Christians really aren't subversive because this and that. There's none of that there at all. The other thing that's lacking is the death of Paul. And it's hard to see why that's not here. There have been two suggestions from liberal perspectives why it's not here. One is, everybody knew what happened to Paul. Well, obviously a fair number of people did know what happened to Paul, but they must have known an awful lot of other things that happened in the book of Acts. They certainly all knew what happened to Jesus. The writer put that in both books. Both Gospel and Acts for one reason or another. I think the explanation for both of these is the book of Acts was written before Paul was put to death, and it was written before the Romans turned against Christianity, and that gives you then a latest possible date of sometime in 64 AD. My guess would be that Luke probably wrote it while Paul was in prison 2 years, and that the last sentence or so of Luke of Acts brings the account up to date. He reaches Rome. That's the last exciting thing, basically, that happened. He has a meeting with the leaders of the Jewish community of Rome. and they begin to dispute with him. Some believe, some don't. He warns them of the dangers of resisting, etc. And then the writer says very quickly, and Paul spent 2 whole years in his own hired house proclaiming the gospel, and people were allowed to come to him, etc. And that's how he ended. My suggestion is those 2 years were probably occupied with putting together the account, which then comes up to date at that point, and so that around 63 A.D. is the right date for the book of Acts. Well, that would put the Gospel of Luke earlier than 63. How much earlier?
Well, there's a lot of stuff in the Gospel of Luke
that refer to incidents where Jesus had this or this to say to someone, and there, a lot of these things aren't found in Matthew or Mark, and some of them are found in Matthew, but they're in a different context in Matthew. And the liberals have drawn all sorts of rather wild conclusions from why certain statements that Jesus said are given in this context in Luke and this context in Matthew. But my suggestion would be, Matthew went around interviewing people, and they told him that they heard Jesus say this and this when he came to our village. And so he put the thing in the account at that place. But Matthew, going around with Jesus, heard him say it in other places too, because itinerant speakers say the same things in different places. That's a standard feature of itinerant preaching, teaching, etc. I do a little of it myself. And if you've got a good sermon and you're speaking to a new audience, why not use it over again? If you can stand it, that is the speaker. The other people certainly, and it should get better the second or third time. And I think that's the best way to explain certain sayings in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke that occur in different places and different times, etc. Is that Jesus repeated some of his material in places. Well, when was Luke ever in Palestine? He was there for about 2 years while Paul was in Palestine in prison. In the book of Acts, we see the we passages carry us from Philippi, where apparently Luke was left on the second journey, from Philippi across the Troas, down the coast of Asia Minor, around and to the port there, Caesarea, and then on up to Jerusalem, and then Paul gets mobbed in the temple, and then he's taken down to Caesarea for safekeeping. No reason to believe that Luke is taken down to Caesarea for safekeeping. But 2 years later, when Paul appeals to Caesar and is sent to Caesar, Luke is with him on the boat when they go. And apparently then Luke has been somewhere in the area for 2 years. What better time than to imagine that he's been going around talking to various apostles and others who had contact with Jesus, and putting together this material and probably even writing it up. And my suggestion is probably it was written in the period 58 to 68, which would make good sense. I don't think we can absolutely prove that, but we don't know of anything like as good opportunity that Luke would ever have had before this time. And he's not going to have too much opportunity after this time. In fact, one would expect that if he had kept all his notes and taken them with him to Rome, they'd probably gotten lost in shipwreck. But if in fact he had written up his notes and such, he would probably have only lost his copy on the way to Rome, and the other copies that had been made in Palestine would have continued to circulate. So a little speculation there, but it fits in well with the information we have regarding the date of the Gospel of the Book of Acts. The only thing it doesn't fit in real well with is if we take Irenaeus' statement about the date of Matthew. Matthew published his Gospel in Aramaic, etc., while Peter and Paul were in Rome, were preaching the gospel and founding the church, etc. If we take that at the time of writing of the Aramaic Matthew, then Luke is earlier than Matthew. But it looks like nearly all the tradition makes Matthew earlier than Luke. My suggestion here is, as I think mentioned once before, but I explained to you now why I think so, is that Irenaeus is giving us the time when it was published in Greek, though it had been written in Aramaic at an earlier time. Suggesting that somewhere back in the 50s or possibly back in the 40s, Matthew was written in Aramaic. But since very few people outside Palestine spoke Aramaic, those who wanted to know what it had to say had to interpret it as they were able. If they knew some, they could interpret it. If they didn't, you seem to get the impression there's a period in which Matthew is the only gospel around, but it's in Aramaic and not many people know it. So there's some difficulty getting materials. And then perhaps Luke comes along with the first gospel in Greek. And so from, say, 58 or say 60 or something like that, it's available in Greek. And then finally, a few years later, Matthew gets translated in Greek. So there are a couple of Gospels available in Greek. Some guesswork there, admittedly, but I think it's not an unreasonable suggestion. Let's move on and say a little bit about the aim and method of Luke. Here we have an explicit statement in the Gospel of Luke, such as we don't have in Matthew and Mark, that tell us why Luke is writing and what he's intending and how he did it. The first four verses of the Gospel, a rather classic sort of introduction, was common among the literary writers, particularly the writers' histories at New Testament times and even from some centuries before, to write an introduction before they got into their history, explaining why they wrote it and how they went about it and that sort of thing. Here's what he says. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you've been taught. We see the aim of the work here. Luke's aim is so that Theophilus might know the certainty of the things he's been taught. Don't know who Theophilus is, but this phrase, most excellent, ahead of his name, is used twice elsewhere in the book of Acts as a title for a government official. So we would venture a guess that this fellow may be a government official of some sort, or at least a wealthy person. It's a title of respect of some sort, something like Your Honor, except that it goes with the person's name, which Your Honor doesn't usually go with. The purpose, the aim, to show Theophilus the certainty or reliability of what he's been taught. We don't know how he's been taught it. Is he interested in Christianity and has heard something about it? Or is he already a Christian and would like some more information? We don't know. But some interest of that sort, and Luke is writing to explain things for him and give him an assurance that this is really true. Apparently he trusts Luke's judgment and abilities. And so he probably knows Luke. That would be a fair bet. And Luke is going back to check out on these things then. Well, it's in Greek, obviously. Theophilus. It's hard to know. Lots of people had Greek names then. There are many, many Jewish graves, for instance, that have Greek names on them. And the only way you realize that they're Greek and not Jewish is that they've got a menorah on the thing or they've got some other Jewish symbol on the thing. Paul had both a Hebrew and a Roman name. Paulus is Roman, Saul is Hebrew. John Mark had both a Hebrew and a Roman name. John Yohanan is Hebrew, and Marcus is a nice Roman name. Several of the other people, though, in the Gospels have a Hebrew and a Greek name. Simon Peter, for instance. Simon is a nice Hebrew name, and Peter is the Greek form of his Aramaic nickname Cephas, means rock. We'll have an example of that. You'll find lots of people in the New Testament period with double names, one of which was Jewish and one of which was Greek. A number of the Maccabean kings had the same thing. They had a Hebrew name and they had a Greek name as well. So that seems to be what we see going on here. Well, excuse me, I don't know whether that's what's going on here with Theophilus, however, because we don't know his background. The name is what we call a theophoric name. That is, it's a name that's got the name of a god in it. But this one's got a very general name. Lover of God, rather than lover of Zeus or Demeter or one of the pagan gods. That might mean that he's from a pagan background, but that his parents happen to use a rather general name. Or it might mean he's from a Jewish background or something. And so they intentionally didn't use any of the pagan names. If you pick the three guys that are mentioned in a third John by name, all of them have pagan names. All three of them apparently were converted to Christianity, but their parents had been pagans. One of them is Demetrius, who was named for the god Demeter. One of them is Gaius, who is named for the god Gaia. And the other is Diotrephes, which means nourished by Zeus. So they all have nice pagan names, which doubtless then, if they were real Christians, they probably did not name their kids with pagan names. So we really can't tell a whole lot here where this guy is. It sounds like the most excellent indicates some kind of an official type position, but a wealthy Jewish person in a right kind of city might well be an official of some sort, and of course a wealthy pagan in the city might well be an official of some sort. The two fellows whom we can test the thing against are both governors of Judea, pretty high position, but we just don't know enough of the term to know how widespread, how wide a range of offices you could apply the term to. Well, that's the aim, then, that Theophilus might know the certainty of these things, and I think it's intended that any other readers might know the certainty as well. It's quite possible that Theophilus is not the only reason for writing the letter, writing the book. Many, many authors would dedicate a letter or a book to someone with the intention that that person would encourage its circulation. You didn't have printing presses in antiquity. The way something got circulated was to get a few people to read it and recommend it to others, and then people would pay to have professional scribes copy the things. There was very little money directly in it in publishing works in antiquity because you didn't get royalties on anything, but there was some fame to be had, and that was enough to drive many people on, as it is today for other activities. What about the method of Luke? I sketched here on page 119 and 20 several features about Luke's method. Luke indicates, first of all, that he's aware of the status of his subject at the time he begins to write about it, inasmuch as many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. It seemed good to me, etc., to do the same thing. He's aware that several people have attempted this. I doubt that he's referring to the existing canonical Gospels. If my suggestions on dating are right, one canonical Gospel is in existence at that time. At this time, it's Matthew, but it's in Aramaic, and very few people know Aramaic, so there'd be need for it. But doubtless, there were many, many Christians who heard the apostles come around and tell them things about Jesus that they wrote down. A type of shorthand existed in antiquity, and surely once you get thousands of people who are Christians, you're going to begin to have some people who know it, know how to do that kind of shorthand, and could take down as somebody lectured what they were saying. So people got things down. But the big problem with that sort of thing, of just taking down what somebody says when they come by, is you don't know how to fit it all together, and you don't know exactly what the significance of this and that is. You've just got the secondhand information. And Luke felt then that rather than depending upon notes that people had made as apostles and such went through the area, something better would be needed. And so he attempts to do something better than that. And so the second step of his method is that he studied all the matters related to the subject rather carefully himself. He remarks upon having carefully investigated everything from the beginning. I don't think investigated from the beginning means he was back when the Annunciation to John was made. He gives no hint in that direction. That was, in fact, a long time ago at even the earliest dates. But let's say if we're talking about 58 A.D. or 60 A.D., we're talking about 65 years ago when that occurred. But that he investigated what information was available about things all the way back to the beginning, all the way back to the time when the Annunciation was given to Zechariah in the temple that led to the birth of John, the Annunciation of Mary, and sort of investigating back to the beginning of the events on earth related to Jesus' ministry. He does start out as early as any of the Gospels, except that John starts out with the pre-incarnate existence of Jesus from the beginning, which, of course, is something that you have to know by revelation, not something you can find out by talking to eyewitnesses, such as what we see Luke doing here is what most historians have to do. There are almost no historians who have lived through all of the incidents that they want to narrate. Even Winston Churchill, who is perhaps as well-placed as anyone when he wrote his history of the Second World War. I mean, you know, he had access to as many documents as any single person would, etc. He still needs to get information from other people to know how to fill in everything. Well, Luke is someone who, if we're right that he's a Gentile, he's presumably converted, say, when Paul goes to Antioch and such, in maybe 45 AD or 43 AD or something like that. But he's in a place where he's got an opportunity now to spend 2 years, perhaps, talking to eyewitnesses who are still alive at a point, let's say 58 AD would be 28 years after the events. There'd be lots of people around. There are lots of people around even now from World War II. And that's 40 years ago already, so lots of people around from the Korean War. Let's see, that's getting closer to the right length away. So that's about what we're talking about. What could you find out about the events surrounding the Korean War in 1985? Well, you had lots of people interview, and you find out a lot by piecing it together and such. That's basically what works on. However, he indicates that he chose a very important special group to get his information from. He has drawn up an account of the things fulfilled among us just as they were handed down, is not a great translation there in the NIV, handed over, entrusted to us, if you like, by the ones who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. The word handed down there in English gives the flavor, this was handed down from my great-great-great-great-grandfather or something like that. But the word actually is a word that can mean that, but it also means something handed over, very precious, and needs to be guarded carefully. So it need not indicate any long distance in time that's involved there. This is material that was handed over from those who were eyewitnesses from the beginning, people who were in contact with Jesus' ministry from the very beginning, and who were servants of the Word. That is, they were ones who had spent their life in serving the Lord and in serving His ministry. So I suppose a person would say, oh, well, they're biased. Why didn't he check with Annas and Caiaphas and such? And who knows? He may well have had opportunities. He had one good opportunity to check with opponents, and that is he had contact with Apostle Paul, who knew what the opponents could say. But the value of this would be that he's checking with people who are in on it from the beginning and who were continually repeating what went on as they trained other people. So they had kept their memory strong by repetition rather than letting it fade out by not thinking about it for 20 or 30 years. But that certainly is an important thing as well. This group would include the apostles, presumably, but might also include people like the 70 and other people who had been ministering, perhaps a pastor in various local congregations in Palestine up to this particular time.
This series is concluded on the next cassette. Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.